Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
All of us can agree on the importance of home in our lives, but what do we mean by home? And once we settle on that home, how do we fit in as part of a larger community? And if there's no community, how do we make one? These are important questions for those who've come to the U.S. from other countries, and even those of us who were born here but may have moved around from place to place. And these are the questions our in-depth guest tonight, Carolina Pfister, asks and tries to answer in her audio project, I See You. Carolina is a multicultural artist and director of the nonprofit organization Culture Seed, who immigrated to the U.S. from her home in Brazil. Carolina describes her work and art as motivated by the belief that to be home is to seek awareness of the life around us, of who came before, and how personal choices, culture, and socio-political structures knit the web of us. We're fortunate to have Carolina live in our KBOO studios to talk about her work and the ICU audio project. The third episode in the series premieres on KBOO tonight at 11 p.m. Carolina Pfister, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina, first, can you tell us a little bit about your experience immigrating to the U.S. from Brazil and why you chose to come to Oregon?
Well, as Latin American immigrants go, I'm not the typical immigrant.
You were originally from Switzerland, right?
Yeah, I was born in Switzerland, and my parents left Brazil during the military dictatorship, and so I was born there and was in Switzerland for the first 6 years of my life. But I consider myself Brazilian because that's where I was shaped, basically. I came to the U.S. for graduate school, not quite sure that I was going to stay, so in that way, it's an atypical immigrant experience. And for a long time, I didn't necessarily call myself an immigrant. I was staying, not sure that I had stayed. But children put a twist in the narrative. And now I understand myself to be an immigrant, and I understand what that experience feels like in terms of being constantly in between. I've been here long enough that I'm not fully Brazilian anymore, and I notice that separateness when I go back home. And I know that I'm never going to be fully from here. So it's an in-between space. And I've noticed other people who have similar experiences echo that sentiment that we live in between.
Now, how does the sense of community in Brazil compare to what you found here in Portland?
Wow. I don't think I can tell you in a neat little package what the differences are. There are cultural differences that feel very real and that feel more so over time, and especially as a mother.
How Brazilian would bring up children as opposed to how an American would bring up children?
Absolutely. And also the fact that I have a very large family in Brazil, and most of the time as a mother in the U.S., it was just our little nuclear family, which is not a sustainable thing, I feel, for the raising of children. And I understand the making of community outside of my family, to be working together, to be actively supporting each other. And this audio project was very much the way in which I chose to make community in Portland. As a mother of young children, it was a way to just be out there with my neighbors. It was an interesting experience.
Actually, that was going to be my transition from community to the audio project, I See You. What was the initial spark of the project? Was it questions you were asking yourself about how you fit in and the differences between raising children in Brazil and family in Brazil versus family in the U.S.? And
all of that. All of it. It's, in many ways, the way I observe day-to-day life, I can't help but always think how the microcosm is a reflection of the bigger structure, and we're a building block, but we also speak to the forces that shape us, you know. From a block level, which was my project, I took out the microphone and recorded my block for a whole year. And then the audio project and what I write and the way that the story is being shaped, it goes from macro to micro. And I feel that when we stop and observe, when we pay attention, a lot of things happen. It not only nurtures a connection that maybe wasn't there before, but curiosity does connect you to place and to your neighbors in a way that if you are living in a neighborhood and not paying attention to those who live around you, you don't have that ownership even. So this project speaks to everything that concerns me and everything I pay attention to, but it was also shaped by then what my neighbors were seeing. In the U.S., I've only lived in gentrifying neighborhoods, and by the time we got to Portland and once again landed in another gentrifying neighborhood, this was also a central question to why I picked up the microphone.
And in Portland, it's not that rare, unfortunately.
No, and I moved here right in the thick of it, 6 years ago. So,
now, was the initial plan, you mentioned recording your neighbors first for a year. Was that with the plan of doing an audio podcast, or kind of not knowing what you're going to do with those recordings? And then how did you get to the point where you came up with this idea of a multi-part series? And I read on the net initially it was 5 episodes, and you told me before the interview it might go 6.
Yeah, I actually had been working around similar themes. I have been working around similar themes forever. And I've been very intrigued by the audio world in the U.S. We don't have strong independent radios in Brazil or an audio tradition. Now it's starting, but definitely not when I left. And I was just blown away by the quality of the podcasting that was happening in the last 10 years here or more, 15 years. And had been really inspired to work with that medium. Also, it's very nimble. It's affordable. As a mother, as a working mother, I could fit it in, these crevices of free time. But I did propose the project as a fully thought-out project already, because I wrote a Regional Arts and Council culture project grant and was fortunate enough to receive that first legitimizing kind of, okay, you got the grant. Now you have to go. Go do it.
And a Caldera artist residency also?
Yeah, which was amazing. So after the full year of recording, I got to go to Caldera, which was my first art residency. And they are also very acceptant of families. And, it just fit very well. And I figured out how to edit this, what the tone would be for the whole thing.
So this next question, I think, is something you probably answered, getting the grants and the residency. You have young twins. You said they're 8 years old now. They announced the closing credits of each episode. So 3 episodes available now. Well, the 3rd episode premieres tonight. And one of them signed off, thank you for listening to my mother's stories. I'm not sure what they're about. So I don't know if this is a fair question, but what would you tell someone that they're about?
Oh, wow. I wish I had a great little rehearsed elevator pitch. I see you.
Your son did a pretty good job, though.
Yeah.
You were asking him questions, what do you think it's about? And he actually mentioned some pretty good things.
Yeah, I think they get that I'm talking about everything. So at one point he said, it's about the world.
That's always a safe answer.
It is. With this mama, it is. I'm thinking about it all. Yeah. I mean, it's called I See You, and it's about stopping and listening, and how does all of this connect to the ways in which we are living together? This is a very urban story, too, especially in the beginning. I won't tell you why it changes later.
Oh, yeah, I know why. Yeah. Well, actually, I do have one question about that.
Please.
But I hope that's a little later, but I hope it doesn't kind of ruin the effect. Well, we're only like 2 episodes in it right now, with the 3rd one tonight, so.
Yeah. No, we can talk about it.
Okay. Now you mentioned these are themes that you've pursued in other artistic works, and you've written essays. There's a book in the works, a children's book. You've made music. You made films. And if we have time, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the film, Viva Viva. You mentioned one reason you decided to do an audio piece, a podcast, was because of the flexibility, and it wasn't all that expensive to get started like a film might be. But there must have been a lot of challenges in ramping up and kind of the learning curve involved.
Well, it's funny. I just kind of threw myself at it. I already loved editing. I've edited my own films.
And audio editing is really just an offshoot of video editing.
And
actually, it's twice as easy, right? Because you don't have
the
visuals.
It's actually quite lovely. I used to love editing audio for films.
Uh-huh.
So I was very excited about the opportunity to just edit audio. And I found it to be as magical as I thought it would be. I am completely hooked. I just want to edit audio. The microphone, yeah, I could have, should have, perhaps had a mentor.
What did you use? Was it a digital recorder and the built-in mics, or did you have an external mic connected to it?
I had an external mic, mm-hmm. yeah. But just around placement, around room tone, around coaching people how to move their bodies around the microphone. You know, later I had some problems. But luckily, I've been doing the project mostly by myself, and then Jesse Stevens, an audio artist that I met at Caldera, volunteered his work to master the interviews and then master the piece itself. So we kind of just exchange files online, and he does his magic, and things come back unhissing and with less tapping around it. And
oh, that's amazing.
Yes.
So he just has a little bit more sophisticated audio editing software.
Exactly.
That he uses.
Which is exactly what I don't want to learn. I love editing and I love mixing, but the mastering just, I wasn't too crazy about it.
Now, as mentioned, there's currently 3 episodes of I See You, with the 3rd episode premiering tonight at 11 on KABU. Let's talk a little bit about each one. The first episode, and they get longer and longer as we go along. The first episode's called Psychic Home, runs about 10 and a half minutes, and that sets up the series. So what were you doing in there? Just kind of a teaser, or putting some context around the remaining episodes?
Yeah, I think for me, Psychic Home is about exactly that. The spaces we call home, be it psychic or physical, and I'm right now in my 33rd home. So home is a very active thing in my life. Making
and that's
home.
Switzerland, Brazil, and Oregon, and maybe other states in the
yeah,
U.S.
Yeah, in the U.S. I've lived in quite a few places, and in Brazil too, hopped around a little bit. And
so the question of home is a big one on your mind all the time.
It is. And the physicality of it, and especially as a mother, making home now is a very powerful thing as I create a space that represents a lot for my children and what that means. But Psychic Home was yeah, you could call it a teaser, although I feel it's a complete setup of...
Well, you get into the neighborhood, which I think is important, yeah. And you mentioned it's one block. It's in Northeast Portland. Can you describe it? It was previously a mostly black neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then it's getting gentrified, so... people who aren't black are moving in, and rents are going up, and housing prices are going up.
Exactly, and that's, you know, exactly the dynamic I landed in once again. Our experience of Northeast Portland was very diverse. We lived on a very diverse block and a very lively block, and something happened on the block that all the parents started coming out because the children were playing with a basketball hoop, and I talk about this in the chapter that's premiering tonight. And as I was observing this, what made us actually get together and actually talk to each other were different depending on who and why. For example, the parents came out because the kids came out. I interacted with one of my African American neighbors after an altercation around noise and learned a lot, as I hope he did too. It was some very honest conversation, some of which I have recorded and is in chapter 2. As far as the typical Portland experience, I feel that we're told it's a very white city. That was not my experience of Portland.
Well, certainly not where you were living. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned there were two black families on the block. You mentioned something that
three.
Okay,
yeah.
Something that seemed ironic, a little funny for me, that there were two Black Lives Matter lawn signs. But they were not on the lawns of the people who own the homes.
They were the middle-aged white women.
So it's a fairly diverse block. I mean, even for Portland, even for a gentrifying neighborhood. And then the person you alluded to as Fred, the neighbor, who I found exceedingly interesting. You mentioned he's mostly covered in the second episode. That's called My Year of Noise. That one runs about 25 minutes. A very descriptive title, because, as you said, that's kind of the issue that is the focus of what brought the neighbors together and focus certainly of episode 2. Fred, our first impression of, we get to know him a little bit better, of course, as it goes along. Our first impression, mine at least, he's rude, he's noisy, he's evasive. How did you meet him and get him to answer at least a few of your questions? He seemed like he definitely did not want to do that.
He didn't. I don't know. I have no qualms about approaching people.
That was very clear from the series.
I try to, you know.
You're very brave. I was going to say bold, but brave sounds better.
Maybe for North American cultural dynamics, I am. But as a Brazilian, I'm pretty typical. We talk to people, no matter who, and the color lines aren't so stark in Brazil. Fred was just a neighbor that I was having some problems with, who was rude once or twice to me, and I didn't walk away. I went up to him and said, well, we're neighbors. We're going to have to, you know, we're going to be here, so let's work this out. And, you know, Fred is a lively man full of stories of the neighborhood, and I really wanted to sit with him.
Oh, he's extremely interesting, yes. Yeah. I just loved hearing him. But yeah, he's very direct.
Yeah, so. He came around. I mean, you know, we negotiated. And there were some points where I don't like the feeling of taking that sometimes comes with interviewing people for a project.
They're giving you something and you're not really giving them anything back in return.
And that's been problematic for me because I tend to storytell with real stories, with things that are happening right now. And that exchange, I've still not made peace with it, what it means to take someone's story. Yeah. So Fred and I actually worked it out in a very objective way because he just asked me for something, which I was like, fine.
Oh, was that the cigarettes and a bottle of scotch?
Or absolutely. Yeah.
It's funny because you initially offered him beer and he said, I don't drink white people beer.
That's right.
Which is funny in Portland.
Yeah. No, he just, yeah. And that was an assumption for him, you know. We were dealing in assumptions.
I was going to talk about that. His assumption was that you're white. Mm-hmm. You describe yourself as a light-skinned Brazilian. Mm-hmm. And visibly, you don't fit in with most people of color, certainly not with the black people in your neighborhood. Has that been an issue for you, in addition to being kind of, you're not American, or you are American, you're Brazilian, you're Swiss? I think you mentioned it earlier, too, about the question of how you fit in.
Oh, absolutely.
And what's the challenges involved? You're not really white. You're not visibly a person of color. It's a very interesting position to be in.
Well, first of all, I've had to learn that here. Brazil's no racial paradise, but we don't divide up in the way that the U.S. has divided up. In terms of colonized countries, Brazil's one that makes the most. We have a variety of colors, and I wasn't aware of that until I lived in the U.S., that this, to speak of each other with these very clear divisions. So I've had to kind of shake.
Race just seems to be a much bigger issue in the U.S.
And please, not that Brazil is a racial paradise, and actually there's been a much more racial consciousness happening in Brazil since I've been gone, and I've been watching it with relief, like finally there's some movement around that. But there is something culturally that happened that we identify as Brazilians. And here it seemed that the immigration story was much more segregated.
Oh, especially now.
Yeah.
And immigrants are denigrated quite a bit.
Absolutely.
Certainly by the current administration.
So I am proud to be Latin American and South American, but Brazilians aren't very counted in terms of the census of immigrants in the U.S. So there's no Brazilian box to check. I don't check a Hispanic box. I can check a Latin American box. And North Americans understand most Latin Americans to not be white. And I will proudly sit in that category because it feels more like me. Hmm. Whatever white is does not feel like me. But the truth is, it's all a construct anyway, right? The racism.
That's the interesting thing with being in the position you're in. You kind of see that, where somebody like Fred assumes you're white.
Well, which I understand why he would.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I'm the lady who bought the house next door, and that's what's happening in his neighborhood. And I probably dress like the white ladies that he's seen around that
neighborhood. And he's not happy what's happening with the neighborhood.
No, but he's funny because I go up to him and say, he asks me, why do you have this microphone? What are you doing? And I tell him a little bit about my story in the U.S., that I've been landing in gentrifying neighborhoods. And I kind of stuttered and said, you know, and I just want to see where I fit in this story. And Fred says to me, well, you fit in where you can get in. You
know? Another one of his great lines.
Yep.
you've got to start from the beginning here of I See You at episode one and then Fred in episode two. I don't want you to delay seeing episode three tonight. Of course, it will be archived on the KBOO website.
So
we should mention that too. But it's well worth catching up on episode one and two before listening
Thank
to episode
you.
Three. Now, Fred is just one of several neighbors we hear from in episode two. Can you tell us about a few of the others? There were two that stood out for me. One was Alan, an extremely voice of reason, the head of the neighborhood association. And then your millennial next door neighbor, Will, who's a drummer in a local rock band and practice late at night. Huh?
Yeah, Will was a reckoning. I'll start with Will because it's ironic, or, you know, it's karma. I've also played in bands half my life and don't remember in my early 20s if I was as conscientious as I should have been. And so, of course, we moved right next door to a young man with a rock band. But it was interesting because as we talked, because it was the band and it was parties and our house was like, you know, 10 feet away from each other. It was really difficult and we had young children and Will and I really had to work through that, you know, Will and his roommates and our family and what it meant to what level of noise was acceptable. I mean, it's fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating to me in which ways we come together and have a social contract of sorts and how does culture inform that, and that's why I feel that a certain awareness just makes for community, because
I think that awareness comes through because it's not just your perceptions, those are very clear in the first two episodes, but it's also you give voice to the people you're talking about, Fred and Will, and it'd be difficult for a lot of us who would have a conflict with a neighbor, especially over noise or leaving their car in the street. I think that was with Fred. It was difficult to get around. His car was parked right in the middle of the road. It would be difficult to try to get past that and understand from the other point of view what was going on. And I think that becomes clear. There's two quotes I especially liked. One, I think, belongs to Will. He says he sees neighbors as mysteries that we don't necessarily have to solve, but to get along, we have to find something to talk with them about. That's pretty wise advice.
That was Alan Silver. And
oh, that was Alan.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Alan is the voice of reason, though. He's the neighborhood association head.
Yes, and he's not our neighbor, but I sought some outside of our block voices. So every episode has, potentially every episode, will have, yeah, a voice from outside the block. Alan Silver, I felt his reflections were...
He's incredible. He should be president.
I agree. You should hear him in chapter three. He takes this idea I'm exploring about what it means to... What is soul of a place?
And that's the name of of episode three.
Yeah.
There was one more quote. This is from, I think, a neighbor on the block, and this is Bob, who's a retired grocery checker at Fred Meyer. He reminded us that our neighbors come from different places and we need to learn to give them space and also tolerate the differences. You had some cool people in that neighborhood.
Well, I feel there's cool people everywhere if we just stop and talk to each other. On a block level, if we're not relating, it's a dissonance that feels very odd to me that you can be on your block for 10 years and perhaps not have met the person that lives across the street, which I witnessed. It's a dissonance I'm not familiar with, and I have other dissonances, cultural ones, but not that one.
No, we have about 2 minutes left. I wanted to get where people could see your work and all that, and I don't think we're going to get to the documentary you did, Viva Viva, which is about the punk scene in Brazil. It came out in 2014. But you mentioned Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the concept of the social contract in episode two. Can you explain just briefly what the social contract is and how that relates to your narrative?
Well, I was looking for examples in the way that I was trying to use social contract and breaking off a little bit from the Rousseau explanation of it, which is more of in a democratic sense, you know. So what are the agreements that we make in order to have a society that functions in a efficient manner?
Like, as opposed to unlimited individual freedom, which can impinge on the idea of community and neighborhood.
Absolutely, which is why I bring up Brazil, because we're such a young democracy and corruption is so cultural that I also do appreciate a lot of the civic engagement that does exist in the U.S. and the awareness around it. Having the ability to reflect from this space in between, I get to see what both versions look like. And
well, we should wrap up. We've got Labor yeah. Radio coming in. Carolina, can you just tell us where listeners can find out more about your work and maybe hear episode 1 and 2 before
yeah.
episode 3 tonight?
Well, 1 and 2 are both on KBOO's website on the podcasting section and on my personal website. Carolina is spelled just like Carolina, but that is not how you pronounce my name. And Pfister is P as in Paul, Pfister. So my personal website also has that. So for now, those are the two websites that host my work.
Well, Carolina, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO. Obrigada.
De nada. Thank you so much for having me, Ken. That was a great conversation.
We've been talking with Carolina Pfister, multicultural artist and director of the nonprofit organization Culture Seed, and writer, producer, and editor of the audio project I See You. You can listen to episode 3 of I See You on KBOO tonight at 11. It will also be archived if you want to catch up on 1 and 2. And you can learn more about Carolina and catch up on 1 and 2 at carolinapfister.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.